Illinois' planting season has been massively delayed as we face one of the wettest springs in more than a century. How are farmers coping with all this uncertainty? Plus, African Americans have been moving out of Chicago for years, not just to suburbs or other parts of Illinois, but also to the South, where there are better economic opportunities. And Attorney General Kwame Raoul is worried alternative energy suppliers are preying on consumers, charging high utility bills.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, while thousands of Black residents are leaving the city of Chicago every year and heading to cities and suburbs in the South for better opportunities. And State Attorney General Kwame Raoul joins us to talk about why he's especially concerned about alternative energy suppliers targeting those least able to afford it. But first, it's been a cold and wet spring here in Illinois, one of the wettest in 124 years, according to the state climatologist's office. Spring showers are a nuisance for most of us, but too much rain can be disastrous for farmers who aren't able to get their seeds in the ground. To make things worse, the trade war with China continues to heat up. How are farmers coping? Well, we thought we'd check in with a few folks who've been following this closely, including Steve Forese. He farms about 500 acres of corn and soy in Vermilion County in East Central Illinois. Steve, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us during this very busy time of year for you.
Thank you.
I wonder if you can explain a little bit about how much you've been able to get into the ground so far this year, Steve?
We're kind of in a pocket where we've been a little lucky and have gotten more progress than the majority of the Corn Belt or the majority of the state. We're well behind schedule. Ordinarily, I'd be done planting soybeans by this time, and I'm not done planting corn as of right now.
Last year at this time, how does this compare? Where were you at? Had everything been planted?
I pretty much had everything wrapped up by now last year.
Steve, I wonder if you can describe for us what it's like to try to plant when it's wet or what you need, what kind of conditions you need to be able to plant?
Where we're at right now is the ground is pretty well saturated, so it doesn't take much in any of these little weather events that have moved through to keep us out of the field. When you're out there, when it's too wet, it leads to problems with packing the soil down and we don't get good root development. Plant development is retarded because the moisture is too close to the surface and it doesn't put down good root systems. So it's not a good situation. And, you know, what we'd like to see is, an adequate amount of moisture, but the soil being dry enough to get across it with the machinery and get the seed in the ground into a good seed bed.
And so I've been taking a look at fields, especially when I've been driving on 57, and I'm seeing lots of puddles of even water that's kind of pooled in different fields. Are you having that as well?
Fortunately, no, but ordinarily I would have. And that makes it even harder because, once you get those saturated areas where the water's sitting on the surface, it takes a long time for that to get away and compounds the problems with the condition of the soil when we can actually get in it and get across it with the equipment.
Steve, a couple weeks ago on the program, we talked about a University of Illinois study that found that too much rain can be just as economically damaging as drought. Do you find that to be true?
Yes, especially this kind of a year, and I kind of alluded to it a minute ago. When you put the seed in the soil when it's this damp, the root system doesn't develop because it doesn't need to pursue the moisture in the soil. And so when you retard that root system under the ground, it doesn't do as good a job of picking up nutrients. And if we do snap off into an extended dry spell, then the root growth can't keep up with the water table as it moves down through the soil profile.
Okay. We're talking with Steve Forries. He's speaking to us from his farm in Vermilion County. And we've got two more folks with us who've been following the weather and news closely. Madeline Beck is a reporter for Harvest Public Media. Scott Irwin is the chair of agricultural marketing in the College of ACES at the University of Illinois. Madeline, Scott, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Good to be here.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Scott, I wonder what Steve's saying, how familiar this sounds to you when we're thinking about farmers across Illinois in terms of the weather we've seen this spring and how they're dealing with it.
No, I think he explained it really well and very clearly. I tend to look at things rather than from a field level. What are the implications for the total size of the Illinois and the U.S. corn crop? What's it mean for yield? What's it mean for acreage? And then ultimately tie that in with price. So that's the angle that I'm constantly looking at the situation from.
Mm-hmm. And what are you? What does it look like right now?
Well, I've been in recent days calling this a true black swan event for U.S. corn planting. We're setting records for the amount of corn in the U.S. Corn Belt that's planted by that is going to be planted after traditional late planting cutoffs like May 15th or May 20th. And we also have the specter of unprecedented amounts of corn that are not even going to get planted, but will fall under something called the prevent plant provision under crop insurance contracts that farmers have already signed. So it really is an unprecedented situation. To me, it resembles, like you started the conversation off a few minutes ago, like we've already experienced a major drought, but it's happened because of problems in terms of actually just getting the corn planted. But from a market perspective, it's beginning to look like the kind of price move that we have with a major drought.
And so you said unprecedented. Madeline, I wonder if you can let us know what the USDA has said about how much is actually in the ground so far this year.
Yeah, no. So the USDA comes out with crop progress reports about once a week. And when it comes to corn, just a couple days ago, the one that came out says that on May 19th, we in Illinois had about 24% of our estimated corn acres planted. Now, last year at this time, we had 95% of our corn acres planted. And that's on a five-year average of 89%. So we are very far behind. We're not the only ones. You've got Indiana, who has only planted 14%. They had 86% in the ground by this time last year. Then you have folks like Ohio, who only have 9% planted. But they only had about 69% planted at this time last year. So, I mean, it's not looking great in these areas that have been really hit again and again by these weather systems, not just this month, which May is, on average, the wettest month in Illinois, but going back several months. And that's the big problem here, is it's just compounding on itself.
So, Madeline, you just mentioned that May is the wettest month. I know you spoke with folks from the Illinois State Climatologist Office about the amount of rain we've gotten this year. What are we looking at in terms of records for rainfall? And this is all over the state, I imagine.
Yeah. And I mean, it's what's funny is it's kind of like a really big sash. It's not 100% over the state, but there's just a little section at the top and a little section at the far bottom that haven't been hit as hard. But the vast majority of the state has been seeing above average precipitation, not just rainfall, but also snowfall. From last May to this last April, so May 2018 to last month, it was the third wettest time period in about 124 years of records in the state. Now, this May is already shaping up to be a really wet one. So that may put us into the wettest May to May period in 124 years, but we're going to keep tracking that. We're not to the end of the month yet, and yet people are already seeing above average rainfall for May.
Madeline Beck's with us. She's on the line from Galesburg, where she's a reporter for Harvest Public Media. Madeline, you spoke with Jared Kungel for your story. He's another farmer. He's in Warren County, and he's got about 2,000 acres. He actually got most of his crops in before Easter, but I wonder, for people who were able to get their crops in, how are they handling things now with the weather?
If they were able to get their crops in that early, I've seen them largely have a sigh in relief. They are going to have to replant a lot of them because of the pooling that we've mentioned. Jared also is getting his pilot's license, so he was able to show me pictures from the sky of different areas of his land that, even though he has tiling, it's just been so wet that there's still some sections that are oversaturated that are still pooling. So he is going to have to replant some sections, but he's at least very thankful that he has gotten seeds in the ground.
Steve, are you thinking that you are going to have to replant some sections?
At this point, I don't see that. That could change overnight with a big rain and get some of it where it's underwater or the ground gets crusted over and the plants can't come through the surface. The biggest thing for me this year has been, we haven't had any large amounts at any one time in my immediate area. It's just every time it starts to dry out enough, we get just enough to put us back where we were at before.
Mm-hmm.
And it just keeps us from getting out in the field and getting the job done.
So we've been talking about the weather, and we haven't been talking about the other news, which is for really impacting farmers, which is when we're thinking about the trade war with China. And Scott, I wonder if you can, as someone who researches agricultural economics, I wonder if you can explain a little bit about the current trade war, maybe catch us up to speed on what's been happening in the past week or two and how you might see this affecting our food and our prices.
Well, what has happened is that there was widespread expectation that a trade agreement was in the works and would be signed sometime maybe this early this summer between China and the U.S. to begin to roll back the tariffs that both sides have placed on a long list of items as the United States is challenging some of the trade practices and internal industrial practices of China. So that was the expectation, and it's kind of a he said, she said situation. The United States officially said that China didn't follow through and reneged on some of their previous points they'd agreed to, and so we walked away largely from the negotiations, and then we said that, you know, there's the potential to put more tariffs on from the U.S. side, which raises the potential for China to retaliate again, which they have partly. So it's just a ratcheting up of the trade tensions and actions between the two countries rather than a hopefully beginning to walk away from the tariff trade war we've been happening. And before all these weather problems hit, this had really sunk the grain markets, particularly the soybean market had gone to, you know, 7-8 year lows in terms of soybean prices. So this was really hitting the farm sector hard before the bad weather that we've been experiencing and have been talking about.
And so I wonder, Scott, what kind of economic impact do you think both of these might have for, let's start with farmers, and then I want to ask about food consumers as well. But when we're thinking about Illinois and how much corn and soy we plant, as well as how much of that we export, what is it looking like right now?
Well, for, you know, there's a variety of estimates out there, but it's probably safe to say that the trade war with China has cost U.S. soybean farmers at least $1 a bushel, and you can make an argument for the cost being as high as $2 a bushel. So it's a very large amount in a state that's a large soybean producer as as we are here in Illinois. Interestingly, in terms of direct implications for food costs, if you're driving down the price of raw commodities like corn, or excuse me, soybeans and feed ingredients that are made out of soybeans because of these trade problems, that actually has a small impact on holding down food prices for the rest of the country.
Steve, for you, how much, I wonder, is this, this is, farmers always deal with a lot of uncertainty, but I wonder how this year, when we're thinking not just about the weather, but also about our trade, our ongoing and some increasingly contentious trade relationship with China, how much this affects you?
Well, it's one of those things where the stress level obviously goes up because we're planting a crop that, under the conditions we're in right now, is not going to maximize its yield probably because of the weather conditions that we're starting out under. And then you start looking at it, okay, we're going to have probably less production when we get to the end of the year, and the prices are not probably going to compensate us as it would under normal conditions for lower production. Usually the price goes up. This time with the trade war things hanging over us, that'll may cancel out the increase in price. So when you start talking dollars per acre, we may be taking a large hit as far as what our return gross revenue is going to be on a dollar per acre standpoint, just because there's these other factors that have nothing to do with my ability to raise a good crop affecting what my net income is going to be at the end of the year.
Yeah, I imagine that's weighing pretty heavily on you. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, Steve. That's Steve Forres, joining us from Vermilion County, where he farms about 500 acres of corn and soy. He's also a board member of the Illinois Farm Bureau. I want to thank Scott Irwin for being with us as well. He studies agricultural economics at the University of Illinois. And Madeline Beck, we will tweet out Madeline's stories that she's been reporting on this for Harvest Public Media, including a lot of those stats that she talked about before. All of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Good talking with
My
you.
pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Enjoyed it.
For tuning in to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. During the 20th century, an estimated 6 million African Americans left the South and came to northern and midwestern cities like Chicago, Detroit, and New York. They came for better job opportunities, to escape Jim Crow laws. We know this as the Great Migration. But when you fast forward to today, our economic picture looks very different, especially here in the Midwest. As you may know, Illinois has been losing residents for 5 straight years. We've talked a lot about college students leaving, but there's another group that's leaving in big numbers, and that's African Americans, especially when it comes to the city of Chicago. Sometimes they're going to the suburbs or to other cities in Illinois, but they're also leaving the Midwest altogether and going back to the South. This decline is so stark that the Urban Institute projects Chicago's black population will sink to 665,000 people by 2030. That's basically half of what it was in the 1980s. All this week, NPR is profiling what full employment looks like across the country, and one of those stories looks at how many African Americans are migrating to the South.
The gun violence started to come closer to where we were living.
We're looking at what cities are growing for young professionals, and Charlotte was always like within the top five.
This is happening in every American city, and it's happening very quickly. This rush of folks with money and choice inward.
That was Don Thomas, Brittany Smith, and Tom Hanchett in audio from NPR. We'll tweet out a link to the full series, but in the meantime, NPR's Jim Zaroli is with us from New York. We've also got Alden Lowry joining us from WBEZ in Chicago, where he's the senior editor of the station's Race, Class, and Communities desk. And William Sampson teaches public policy at DePaul University in Chicago, where he studies race, housing, and poverty. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Hello.
Alden, I wonder if I can start with you. When we think about people moving and migration, I think oftentimes we tend to think about this in terms of jobs, and we'll get to that. But Alden, you wrote about this last year in the Chicago Sun-Times, and you call this the Great Black Exodus. I wonder if you would mind sharing your own personal experience with the housing market as an example of the economic pressures African-Americans in Chicago might be facing.
Sure, Nyla. Thanks for having me on. So one of the things that was really apparent to me in my experience was just how much the mortgage meltdown, the economic crisis, the recession that we went through more than a decade ago, and how the recovery just has not come to particularly to African-American communities in and around Chicago. My own story essentially was buying a home in 2005. My first home, me and my wife purchased in a neighborhood where I spent most of my childhood. So it was great to be back in that area. I felt a lot of pride in the purchase and where I was located, and took care of the home, paid the mortgage faithfully every month, put a new roof on the house, installed central air. You know, we were really doing our best to upgrade and take
invest.
Care of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then lo and behold, maybe a decade later, 2015 or so, we're looking around, a lot of decay in the neighborhood, a lot of foreclosed homes. And when we were inquiring about what we could get for our home if we had decided to sell, we discovered that we were literally $90,000 underwater. And we still owed about $40,000 more than what the home was, what we had left on the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we made the tortured decision to walk away from the home because we weren't sure what else we could do. We just didn't think that the values would come back in any time soon, and that the best thing was to kind of cut our losses at that point. And in looking at research and numbers in terms of what homes are going for, many Black communities in Chicago are just overrun with properties that are distressed that you can literally buy for probably a tenth of what the properties were actually sold for originally, homes going for as little as $15,000, $20,000, $30,000. And for someone living in a neighborhood where there's a glut of those kinds of properties available, it just really depresses the value of whatever home you might be seeking to sell, no matter what condition it's in.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So when we're
thinking about housing, Alden, I wonder, so that's kind of a little bit of the housing picture. Professor Sampson, I mean, Alden, you decided to stay. Some people who are in your situation maybe decide to move. And when we think about Professor Sampson, you've described African Americans moving in search of opportunity both as a result and a cause of economic insecurity. I wonder if you can explain what you mean by that.
Well, there were, as was the case in a number of cities across the country, HUD mandated the tearing down of most high-rise public housing projects around the country. In Chicago, the two biggest were Cabrini-Green and Robert Taylor Homes, housing thousands and thousands and thousands of poor Black folks. When those were torn down, nothing replaced the Robert Taylor Homes, which was 17-story buildings full of people. Those thousands of people had to go somewhere, and they were all poor people. With respect to Cabrini Green, it was rebuilt, but only one-third of the new housing was available to public housing tenants. So a whole bunch of poor Black folks were displaced, and the question was, where do they go? They were all renters. As you pointed out early, most of the Black folks who moved to places like Chicago during the Great Migration came from the South. So an awful lot of Black folks in Chicago had roots in the South, and a lot of these people who were displaced and or decided that the cost of living here was too high and the available jobs were the number of available jobs was too low, decided to pick up and go back south.
they may not have been raised in the South, but they often had relatives there. And the cost of living in the South was much lower. So even if they couldn't find great jobs, the cost of housing and food and clothing was probably half or less of what it is in Chicago. Plus, they had an awful lot of Black folks who retired in Chicago who could take Northern dollars South. And those Northern dollars are going much further in the South, especially when you're on a fixed income. So a lot of people were forced to move, and the options were not rosy in the Chicago area, particularly for renters. And a lot of retired folks figured the South made much more sense because their dollars were going much further.
That's Professor William Sampson. Jim Zarelli is also with us from NPR. And Jim, when we're thinking about workers who are moving, we were hearing Professor Sampson talk about the situation with retirees. What does it look like when we're thinking about jobs, when we're looking at the overall African-American unemployment rate now nationally?
The unemployment rate for African-Americans is the best it's ever been. It's 6.7%. The rate for the country as a whole is 3.6%. So the level for African-Americans is disproportionately higher than the country as a whole. Same thing for Hispanic unemployment, higher, you know, it's higher than the country as a whole, but still historically low. So everyone is benefiting from this long recovery in the job market that we've seen since 2010. The job market is very tight, and employers talk a lot about how they can't fill jobs. So African-Americans are benefiting, though they still lag behind.
Mm-hmm. And then I know that one of your NPR colleagues spoke with a demographer in North Carolina named Jessica Barron. She said, and this is a little bit to professors, I wonder if you could explain. She said, opportunities for Black folks in the South have never been in the same sentence, but that has changed.
Yeah. The South for a very long time was very poor. There weren't a lot of opportunities for anyone. You know, my own mother's family left North Carolina for the North during the Depression. My grandfather became a laborer at Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland. And it was the same for a lot of African Americans. They moved to places like Chicago and Detroit and New York because there were better job opportunities. The level of segregation that you saw in the South was not the same in the North. Now we're in a different era. There's been a lot of economic growth in places like South Carolina and Georgia. And we've seen something of a reversal. People have been moving there because there are better opportunities. That's happened for a while, for several decades, really, but it has intensified in the past few years.
Jim, why do you see this? Why do you think this is happening? Is it mostly about economic opportunity?
Well, I cover economics, so that's the way I kind of look at this. I think cities like Charlotte and Raleigh and Jacksonville, Atlanta, they've become very big metro areas, and their economies are booming. I mean, Charlotte in particular is a big finance and tech center now. Wells Fargo and Bank of America are there. A lot of healthcare jobs. And as these economies have grown, these cities have become very diverse racially. I mean, there always were a lot of African Americans in places like Charlotte and Atlanta, but they've attracted a lot of different kinds of other people as well. Mecklenburg County, which is where Charlotte is now a majority-minority county. The African-American population has gone up slightly. It's gone from 31.3% in 1980 to 34.2% in 2010. But the real change has become just a lot more immigrants, especially from Latin America. And they come in part because there are lots of jobs, but it's also affordable. Which, you know, if you're coming
right,
from New York.
Right, to Professor Sampson's point, right? A northern dollar goes a lot further in the South. I wonder if we could play a little bit more of some audio we heard at the start of this conversation. Tom Hanchett is a historian in Charlotte who focuses on cities and housings. And I think he was talking a little bit to your point, Jim. Here's part of what he said to you guys.
This is happening in every American city, and it's happening very quickly. This rush of folks with money and choice inward.
Jim, I wonder if we're thinking about that in terms of people with money and choice, what kind of socioeconomic class we're thinking of folks who are moving. We were talking originally about manufacturing jobs, but are we seeing this across all sectors of the economy?
Well, I mean, in this economy today, people with education and skills just have an advantage over everybody else. I mean, it's stark. It's a stark divide. The people that we spoke with in our series included, you know, educated people, educated African Americans. We spoke to a woman named Brittany Smith. She lived in Detroit. She worked in healthcare. Her fiance was a college counselor. After the recession, they both had a lot of trouble finding jobs. Now they've gone to Charlotte. She, Brittany, got a job doing community outreach for a health insurance company. Her husband, got a job as a college counselor. So people who are college educated, and these are the kinds of people across the country who are doing well in the economy, people with skills.
Mm-hmm. That's NPR's Jim Zaroli. Alden Lowry is also with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Alden, on the flip side, I wonder if we could talk about what this means for those of us who are here and left here in Illinois. And as someone who's still living and working in Chicago, I wonder if I could ask you how the movement of people out of the city, whether it's to the suburbs or to other Illinois cities or to the South, has affected majority Black neighborhoods.
It's had a profound effect, Nyla. You know, I would say many African-American communities, particularly lower-income African-American communities that have a lot of deficits, if you will, the one asset they had was volume. It was volume that could help them attract the economic development, that would give them political power, so on and so forth. And so as those numbers have thinned out, and it's the lower-income African-American communities that have actually really seen the majority or most of the population decline, relatively economically stable African-American communities in the Mid-South area, just north of Hyde Park, places like Kenwood and Douglas, places where there's been a fair amount of development, a lot of incoming higher-income African-Americans and other folks have moved to those neighborhoods. They're actually doing okay, but, you know, places on the west side of places farther south on the south side have struggled a great deal. That's where you've seen the glut of school closings because of the depopulation and declining enrollment in the schools there. You've seen struggles in terms of housing as people have moved away. Housing stock has deteriorated. It's been demolished, particularly in places like Inglewood and West Inglewood, and it hasn't been replaced. There are blocks in the Inglewood neighborhood where literally they're, you know, it's like something rolled through and cleared parcels and parcels of land there. It's just kind of sitting empty and vacant. People have, you know, planted farms and other things like that to try to make use of the vacant property, but it's very noticeable just driving through the neighborhood. So it's had a I would say a very dramatic impact in those lower income parts of town.
And it sounds well, Alden, it becomes almost a vicious cycle of the schools are not as good, so then more people who can are moving away. Professor Sampson, we've got folks listening from all across Illinois, and I wonder how you think people outside of Chicago should be looking at this, how concerned they should be. Obviously, I mean, we've mostly talked about economics. We haven't talked about the cultural loss of this, but I wonder how you want people to be thinking about this out migration.
Well, your last guest in his opening comments made an excellent point. That is a big issue for everybody in America. The movement, particularly of upwardly mobile Black people out of historically Black communities, which has been going on for some time, but has accelerated in the last 20, 30 years, has taken not only economic stability, but role models, people who provided the stability, the core in Black communities across the country. Those people are gone. And that's not only taken a big economic bite out of those communities, but it's also taken role models and guidance for younger folks. And those young folks now, you know, the only successful folks in a lot of these communities are people who are breaking the law. The former, you know, school teachers and social workers and brick masons who used to live in those communities and were responsible in large measure for keeping those communities solid and on track are gone.
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to stop you there, Professor Sampson, because we're out of time, but you've left us a lot to think about. I want to thank Professor William Sampson at DePaul University, WBEZ's Alden Lowry, and Jim Zaroli from NPR. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it. We'll tweet out more of these stories as well for folks who are interested in learning more. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's that time of year where you don't know whether you need heat or air conditioning, but either way, those can lead to high energy bills, whether you're using a traditional utility company or if you've signed up for an alternative energy supplier. Maybe you've gotten those letters at home that ask you to switch companies. Well, the State Attorney General's office says consumers should be careful with alternative energy suppliers and their marketing practices. In fact, the office says a lack of transparency and deceptive promises have led to consumers paying hundreds of million dollars more in electricity, and they're targeting the folks who can least afford to do this. Attorney General Kwame Raoul is now pushing a bill called the Home Energy Affordability and Transparency Act, or the HEAT Act, he says will help address this problem. I spoke to Attorney General Raoul earlier this morning. Attorney General, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the HEAT Act, I wanted to ask you about something that's been making headlines, and that's Alabama's new abortion law. I know it's on a lot of people's minds on both sides of the abortion debate. Last month, the Michigan Attorney General said she wouldn't enforce any restrictive laws in her state, particularly if Roe versus Wade were to be overturned. And as people are talking about that, if perhaps this Alabama law made it to the Supreme Court and Roe versus Wade was overturned, I wonder how you would see your role in the Attorney General's office is responding to that.
Well, I sit upon a campaign for Attorney General very explicitly talking about a woman's access to reproductive health care. As a state senator, I voted for a bill that created a trigger in case Roe v. Wade was overturned. So I feel pretty secure about Illinois' perspective on a woman's access to health care. I'm not just a law enforcement officer for the state. I'm also an advocate. And so I would advocate for policy to support a woman's access to reproductive health care.
Thanks. Let's talk about something else you're advocating for, which is this utility bill. And this issue of, first of all, consumers who are perhaps being targeted by alternative retail energy suppliers. Can you first remind us who we're talking about when we're saying an alternative retail energy supplier?
Yeah, sure. So years ago, the legislature set upon trying to create more competition in the energy supply market for gas and electricity, and with the idea of that competition would thereby reduce costs. As a primary goal of it, that hasn't really been the result. These are folks who, I think most of us have come upon them on one front or the other, whether in a shopping center parking lot or door-to-door salesperson or telemarketer, folks who offer miles on an airline.
Or those letters that they send to your house, right?
Exactly, or with incentives such as gift cards and so forth. And the idea, or the often is that consumers are given teaser rates that will indeed lower the utility rate for a short period of time, and then they spike up, and before one knows it, they're automatically renewed into a contract that has them at a much higher rate, and that they're penalized for trying to get out of that contract. And they have particularly honed in on low-income communities. I spoke to one legislator who said that outside of a public aid office, there were people targeting people coming out of there. So what we're trying to do with legislation is to, one, make sure that people of low income are not targeted. We prevent those who are on a LIHEAP program or a PIP program, a percentage of income payment plan program, which are low-income consumers, cannot be signed up by one of these retail energy suppliers.
So, Attorney General, I wonder when we're thinking about how people are being targeted, first of all, it sounds like you're saying what's deceptive about this, or I imagine you would say this is perhaps deceptive, is these introductory rates that then switch and then people are stuck into these contracts. Am I right in saying that you think there's some deception there?
Yes, absolutely, in a lot of cases.
And so how would you suggest people be on the lookout for these things? Because I imagine that there are also legitimate offers out there for people to switch to other energy suppliers, correct?
Yeah, so there's an argument made by the industry, and I think it's, you know, it could be a credible argument that, you know, people may voluntarily want to pay a premium for a certain utility services, whether they want to embrace green, clean energy or whether they're embracing tools that would allow them to manage their costs, things of that nature. And so arguably there's a legitimate place for the retail energy suppliers. But in a high number of situations, it is the deceptive practices that are being employed, anything from bringing in folks who are bilingual to target people who speak English as a second language, and it is incumbent upon us to make sure that particularly people for whom it really matters, people who are living from month to month, that they're not unduly burdened with energy costs when they could be paying far less with their regular utility provider.
So this would be laid out in this Home Energy Affordability and Transparency Act, or the HEAT Act, that is making its way through the State House now. As you well know from your time in the legislature, we're in a very busy period leading up to the end of session. Where do you think where are you hoping this act gets through in this session?
Well, I'm optimistic. You know, we've already passed out of the Senate with a bipartisan vote. I should mention that, you know, my predecessor initiated this effort last year, unfortunately it didn't advance. There was an effort towards the end of the session to try to advance a bill. We're in conversations in the House of Representatives now, and I'm very optimistic about getting a bill that would bring about reforms that would protect consumers and would put them on a better notice of what they're getting into, that they would know the price to compare. They would know what they're signing up for compares to the price of their regular utility provider, that they would have enough speed bumps and notice that they would be renewed into a different contract that might have variable rates or just a simple higher fixed rate, that people know what they get into, because oftentimes people are not reading the fine print. And so we want for them to have very conspicuous notice of what they're getting into.
That's Attorney General Kwame Raoul talking about the HEAT Act. We'll, of course, be paying attention to this in the final weeks of the legislative session. Attorney General, thanks for taking the time to be with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This act is also supported by other consumer advocacy groups, including the Citizens Utility Board and its director, David Collada, joins us now. David, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me on.
David, before we get to just this bill, which I know you all support, I wonder what advice you have for listeners right now so they can make sure they are protecting themselves.
Well, this is a market that's really not working well for consumers at all. So we would encourage folks who are considering any offer from an alternative supplier to really do your homework. It definitely pays to be an educated consumer. We have been tracking as many offers as we can through the years, and it's very rare when we see a deal that will ultimately save you money. It's not necessarily impossible, but this is certainly a buyer beware marketplace. And one of the things, obviously, this is a huge issue. It's a big source of complaints, the biggest source of complaints, really, we receive from consumers here at Cub. We really want to crack down on this. That's why we support the HEAT Act. But, you really can't have a market that works well when you have so much misleading marketing and fraudulent practices. So it's a reason why I think it's in the industry's benefit, really, to help clean it up as well.
And when we're thinking about the industry, do you think this is a problem of just a few bad actors, or do you think there's something about the industry itself that is encouraging this kind of behavior?
Well, the biggest problem is with the bad actors. There is just a lot of way more marketing that is misleading and outright fraudulent than we'd like to see. We receive complaints here at Cub about people who were, promised savings and only to actually not have them materialize. There are far too many cases of people not authorizing a switch and being switched. So I think that the bad actors are definitely, probably the biggest problem. The market in general, we aren't seeing many offers, not really that are constructed in ways that could offer savings or good deals for consumers. So we definitely think this is a market that's not working well right now. I think one of the problems is that you have seen bad business models, unfortunately, seem to succeed. And I think it's important that the HEAT Act get across the finish line here so that we can crack down on these types of actors and really provide consumers with the types of information they need to make good decisions.
David, we're seeing this happen all across Illinois, these offers and this behavior.
All across Illinois in the ComEd and Ameren service territory. So if you're in a municipal utility, you're not seeing them, but it's all across Illinois, and it's a big problem. I mean, we receive more complaints about some small marketers than you could possibly imagine, given just how few customers some of them have. So it's a big deal, and I think that ultimately, if you look at the HEAT Act, it requires that all the marketing materials provide what the utility price is, so you have some information that you can compare. And it's just, we think, very much commonsensical provisions here that will provide consumers the information they need to make smart decisions. But right now, certainly our advice would be, take some time, think about it, do your homework, and you can certainly go to citizensutilityboard.org. We have information on the kinds of questions that you should ask and the type of information that you really should ask for from any alternative supplier.
One last quick question for you, David. Are you confident this will pass by May 31st?
We're cautiously optimistic. I think so. It did pass the Senate with a bipartisan majority. I think we've got a lot of momentum. I think increasingly senators and representatives know that this is a big problem. And we receive a lot of complaints via representatives and state senators, their offices, when they're like,
so people are complaining to lawmakers about this,
too. So people are complaining to lawmakers, too, yeah. So
okay. Well,
we're hopeful.
We will tweet out that information. We'll have it at our website as well. David Kalata, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. David, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Before we go today, we wanted to remember veteran reporter and columnist for the Rockford Register Star, Chuck Sweeney, who passed away yesterday. Sweeney had worked at the Register Star for exactly 35 years. He covered politics before becoming an unapologetic opinions columnist and most recently a senior editor. Known as a Rockford icon yesterday, everyone from Congressman Sherry Bustos to Governor J.B. Pritzker took note of his life's work. Sweeney was known to grill visitors at the paper's editorial board meetings and then write a scathing column explaining why that person's position was balderdash. Yesterday, in a rare op-ed about, rather than by Sweeney, the newspaper said that its family had been diminished as the entire Rockford community. And they added, quote, "Chuck was the face of the Register Star and gave the newspaper a personality it sorely needed. He could be curmudgeonly, but he loved Rockford, which is why he was so critical of the politicians, developers, and special interest groups who impeded the city's progress." Sweeney was 70 years old and leaves behind a wife and two children. That does it for us today on the 21st. Tomorrow, you might have heard a lot about the Green New Deal in national news from members of Congress all over the country. But what do Illinois' representatives, what's our congressional delegation, how are they thinking about that? We're going to talk about that tomorrow. I mentioned Twitter a couple times. Our handle's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. We're also on Facebook if you want to search for the 21st to like us. That's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, text us, follow us on social media. All you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows archived there, and you can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify now, as well as iTunes and NPR One. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.